Solomon and Matthew. Once they burrowed under your skin, they were there to stay, like the heads of chiggers. There wasn't a miserable deed or an act of charity in the good book that didn't resemble something I'd witnessed and had sometimes been part of. The words of those drifters and cobblers and drones and harlots and the odd bearded king were more accurate than the farmer's almanac. At length the swishing stopped, a door thudded into its frame, and I was alone. Still, I didn't stir from the pulpit, although I folded my pages and poked them into my breast pocket near the revolver in its rig. I stood gazing at the empty pews, feeling the reflected warmth from the squares of daylight creeping toward the east windows, smelling candle wax and walnut stain and the eternal dust of the eternal, the presence of the Lord in every restless grain, searching for a place to lay his head and not finding it for more than a moment. I brought up the Bible from its shelf beneath the lectern, rested it on its loose spine, and let go. It fell open to 2 Kings chapter 20. In those days was Hezekiah sick unto death, and the prophet Isaiah the son of Amoz came to him and said unto him, Thus saith the Lord, Set thine house in order, for thou shalt die and not live. I found that unsatisfactory. I was riffling through the pages for something more encouraging when a window flew apart and I fell over backward with what felt like the entire church resting on my chest. Chapter 25. I'd had my fill of being shot at, whether I was part of the plan or not. When I realized I hadn't been hit, that when the bullet came through the window I'd gripped the edges of the pulpit from instinct and brought it down with me, landing on my chest and knocking out my wind, I got mad and shoved it off with strength I didn't have under ordinary circumstances. The Dean Adams was in my hand now, and I made my way on knees and elbows to the broken pane, wheezing as I did so. I couldn't seem to take in enough air to satisfy my need. It was like swimming in deep water without having gulped in enough oxygen first. I raised my head just high enough to see out, resting the barrel of the revolver on the sill, strewn with glass fragments and shards of molding. Out in the street, the driver of a wagon loaded with furniture was straining at the lines, trying to keep his brace of wall-eyed, pawing grays from plunging, and townsmen were leaning out through doors and around the sides of porch posts, looking toward the church or turning their heads toward the rooftops across the street. That meant a rifle or a carbine discharging loudly enough in the open air to alert the town. When the gawkers ventured out from cover and started churchward, I knew the shooter was long gone. I stood. Too fast. A swarm of bats flew off their perches inside my head, blocking out the light. I fell into the middle of them. The crack in the plaster ceiling looked familiar. The first time I'd seen it, I thought it looked like the bad map I'd followed into Murfreesboro with General Rosecrans. It was directly above the iron-framed bed in the parsonage. Something tinkled. I thought of pieces of glass falling out of the window frame in the church and reached for my suspender scabbard, but I wasn't wearing it or a shirt. I lay stripped to my waist on the top sheet. I took a tentative breath, then a deeper one. The air was as sweet as sugar. I gulped in a bellyful and let it out in a whoosh. It's amazing, is it not, how grateful one can be for the things he takes for granted once he's been deprived of them. But then I shouldn't have to tell a minister that. I recognized the voice without knowing why. I turned my head and watched a man with a spray of beard to the third button of his waistcoat returning instruments to his case. That was the tinkling I'd heard, and I knew him now for Dr. Littlejohn, one of the town's practitioners and a man who'd approved of both my sermons at the church door. He was sitting in the straight back from the sitting room, wearing a Masonic medal on his watch chain. He had the same insignia in brass on the latch of his black leather bag. I wondered if he was a creature of Freemasons or just a member of the Brotherhood. I used my tongue to clear the cobwebs from my mouth. I had a horse squatting on my chest. My voice still sounded like corn husks rustling. I thought at first you had a collapsed lung, but by the time I had your shirt off, you'd begun to breathe normally, so it must have been temporary paralysis brought on by physical trauma. Pulpits are meant to stand behind, not used as counterpanes. You blacked out because you weren't taking in enough oxygen to feed your brain cells. I was afraid I'd have to crack your chest and insert a rubber tube to draw off the pressure. Have you ever done that? No. I confess I was a little disappointed not to have the opportunity. Are you always this honest with your patients? My practice would be more successful if I weren't. You're rather an unusual man in your profession yourself. Men of God have been shot at before. Not many react in kind or so quickly. That piece of furniture that fell on you is solid hickory. Most men would still be struggling to get out from under it when help arrived. You tossed it aside like a match and threw down on the enemy. I turned my head the other way and was relieved to see the Dean Adams on the nightstand. It's the second time in a week I had a bullet pass close to me. You get mad. Wrath isn't necessarily a sin. In this case, it may have saved your life. You could have suffocated under the constriction. Who? Mrs. Freemason. She was on her way here for a visit when the shot rang out. She found you passed out on the floor and sent for me. By the time I got here, she'd recruited volunteers to carry you in here. I told her that was unwise. For all she knew, you had a broken back, and moving you might have been fatal. She said she knew a broken back when she saw one. How do you suppose she knew that? He sat back with the bag on his lap, his hands resting on his thighs. She's a woman of many parts. Where is she? In your sitting room. She's been waiting 20 minutes. I told her she should go home, but she demurred. Demurred. He frowned in his impressive whiskers. I agree, the term seems inadequate. However, she has a way of slamming the door soundly on an argument with the air of someone declining an invitation to badminton. She's a well-bred Jenny. What do I owe you? I have my soul to consider. A day and a night in that bed will suffice for what my counsel is worth. I've an idea you're a mule from the same paddock. I always heard the Masons were honest men. He fingered the engraving on his bag. The clergy hasn't always been so charitable toward the order. When Father Kress sees me coming, he crosses himself as if I were the Prince of Lies in person. Is it true your founders claim to have removed the body of Christ from its tomb? That's a canard, he said, reddening. Catholic fanatics have been repeating it since before the Inquisition. We are a benevolent foundation, and as such represent competition with the Church. There's the source of these centuries of black blood. The emotion in his voice assured me of his affiliation. I said I'd pray for him. His color paled to normal. He rose, rested his bag on the chair, and drew the blanket up from the foot of the bed to cover me to the collarbone. The proprieties, don't you know? I'll send her in now, but she can't stay long. I want to check your ribs while you're conscious to make sure they're not cracked or pinching. I'll bind them if they are. You bled a bit through the knees of your trousers, probably from lacerations when you were crawling through broken glass. They'll need cleaning and sticking plaster. I can see to that, and the ribs. This isn't the first spill I've taken. I didn't realize preaching the gospel was so dangerous. I'd forgotten myself. The brain is slowest to recover when you've stepped back from the stony edge. I was an awkward child. All the same, he said after a tense moment, I'll stay and complete the examination. We can't have you surviving an attempt on your life only to pierce a lung with the end of a broken rib. You haven't asked why I was shot at. I assumed it was because of the subject of your sermon this morning. Judas is somewhat less popular in the state of Texas than General Santa Anna. That was a bald lie, the assumption part, and he could see I knew it, but I didn't press the point. If there's a man who can keep a secret as well as a minister, he has Doctor in front of his name. Nevertheless, here was one more recruit to the side of the doubters. In a little while, that shot would be heard throughout the panhandle. My sheep's clothing was falling away in great bloody patches. She came in with none of the hesitation of a respectable woman entering a man's bedroom, as if she were walking into her own. I'd seen her do that with me following, but that wasn't going to happen ever again. She had on the velvet dress she'd worn to church without the hat. The sunlight coming in through the front windows made a copper-colored aura around her pinned-up hair. Black as it comes, there is always red in it. I gathered myself into a sitting position. I was careful about it, but a phantom blow struck my chest as if the pulpit had taken a second crack at me. I leaned back against the bedstead, breathing with my mouth open. No pinches, at least, so maybe no cracked ribs. I'd cracked my share all right, falling off horses and grappling with unarmed fugitives, which made me something of an expert. "Nasty bruise," she said, glancing at my chest. Call it divine retribution. It could have been worse. A Spencer packs a hell of a wallop inside its range. "You saw it?" "I didn't have to. I was expecting it." "Evidently." I lifted a hand and let it drop to the blanket. I thought it would happen out in the open. I fell into the sanctuary trap. That isn't a mistake I'd have made a few weeks ago. When the disguise assumes you, it's time to take it off and pin the badge back on.
"You never pin it on."
That's what I was saying. That collar cuts off the blood flow to the brain. My instincts of self-preservation went with it. She transferred the doctor's bag to the floor, inspected the seat of the chair for dust, and sat, resting her reticule in her lap.
"I was certain you were dead."
"I disappoint a lot of people."
"I'm the one who sent for the doctor."
"There wasn't any reason not to once you saw I hadn't been shot."
"I'm many things, Paige, but a murderess isn't one of them."
I let that blow in the damn Texas wind. "What were you coming to see me about?"
"You're welcome. I should have known you wouldn't fall all over yourself with gratitude."
"Thanks. What were you coming to see me about?"
"I came to warn you."
"You came late."
"I was late finding out. You're behaving as if you wished it were anyone else."
"It wouldn't be the first time when it was you."
"We weren't always enemies, you know."
I said nothing, watching her.
She shook her head infinitesimally. "Don't pretend. You never did know when I was bluffing."
The reticule was purple, trimmed with yellow, to match the rest of her kit. Colleen Bauer was capable of letting her house burn down around her while she selected just the right ensemble for flight. She untied the bag and brought out a small rectangular envelope with the initials CB embossed in one corner. The B standing for either Bauer or Baronet, her most recent married name, but one. She wasn't the kind to let a powerful man like Freemason slap his brand on her. The word brand echoed in my head for any number of reasons. It turned a lingering trace of cold fire like incendiaries on Independence Day. My mind was still moving at a dead walk. I took the envelope from her gloved hand.
"Your whole card?"
"A note.
I couldn't be sure I'd find you in. God alone knows where a minister goes after the last amen."
I lifted the flap, took out the matching letterhead, and snapped it open.
You're in greater danger than you know. It was unsigned, but I knew her hand. I ran my thumb over the indentations the pen had made in the soft rag stock. There was a pale spot in the lower loop of the D where the ink had run out and she'd paused to re-dip. She couldn't have manufactured it in my sitting room, and 20 minutes weren't enough to make the round trip to her house and back. A woman of her standing in the community couldn't afford to carry around a pot of ink and risk a stain on her handbag. A pencil and coarse paper were the only writing paraphernalia in the parsonage. She was telling the truth. I waited for the earth to slip off its axis, but it went on creaking around, one miracle at a time. I stuck the note back in its envelope and returned it. In that moment, I knew my brain had been trying to tell me something. I saw the brand on Freemason's buggy horse, I said.
He puts it on everything. He doesn't belong, but he's obsessed with it because of his name. He wouldn't have the patience to go through initiation.
Her husband's brand was a stylized version of the Masonic compass and square. A V overlaid with an inverted V. Hand me that bag, I pointed to the doctor's case on the floor. She hesitated, then complied. I rooted among the brown bottles and wicked-looking instruments inside, found a grease pencil, and made alterations on the fraternal symbol etched on the latch, drawing 2 lines only, closing the V's, making 2 interlocking triangles. Chapter 26.
A Star of David, she said.
Just a star. This one never had anything to do with religion.
Is that the brand you saw on the bandits' horses?
One horse, but I've been all through that with Freemason. You can always tell when a string was raised under the same conditions. It only takes 20 seconds with a running iron to change 2 intersecting V's into a star. Freemason was smart enough not to send the blue bandanas out marauding on horses wearing a mark from his spread, but he's a sheepman. He underestimated a cowboy's eye.
Not by much, in this case.
I haven't swung a lariat since you were in swaddles, but it's true I was tardy. Thinking like a minister and a lawman and a saddle tramp all at the same time is a challenge. I dropped the pencil back inside the bag and pushed it aside. Where'd he tip his hand with you?
His foreman was careless about shutting the door to his study. Richard sent for him. I overheard just enough to find out where he was sending him from there.
Tell me about the foreman.
Jack Collender, a rough character who thinks he's a devil with women. I've seen how he watches me when he thinks I'm not looking, but he's too smart to take it any further with the boss's wife. He'll never find a billet that pays as well. Richard could hire a full-time ranch manager for less.
Did you ever ask him what Collender does to earn it?
I just keep the books. Not asking questions I don't need to know the answers to is the trade I made for his not asking me the same.
I thought you said there were no secrets between you.
Plainly there are. I never knew how many until he accused me of betraying him by not telling him who you were.
I can see why that would make you angry enough to come running here.
I walked. I have a reputation to maintain. And you know me better than to think I'd throw over everything I have because my pride got stung.
I searched her eyes. I didn't know her at all. You don't want to see me murdered. I'll take that as a compliment. Does Collender have a broad West Texas accent?
Who doesn't? When I first came here, I had to learn a whole new language. For a long time, I thought Bob Wire was one of Richard's hands. When I found out it was a kind of fence, I sat down and listed the names of all the people I made a fool of myself with and who didn't bother to set me straight. That turned out to be a good thing. You can waste a lot of time learning who your enemies are. Who else is he overpaying?
Fiello, but that's a favor to me. It costs more to feed a breed ram than to staff a house with Mexicans, so what he makes doesn't scratch the budget.
He's quiet, respectful, and he has only one vice.
Can you say the same?
I let the wind take that one as well. The others must be in it for a percentage. I'm betting they tent up at the ranch between raids. What buffaloes me is why Captain Jordan and his rangers couldn't tie any of them to descriptions of the blue bandanas when they visited.
I remember that day. Colander wasn't around. Someone cut the north fence and he took some men and followed a trail of slaughtered sheep as far as the nations.
How many men?
5 or 6.
6. Freemason made sure the gang was absent when Jordan came to call. If the fence was cut, they cut it. If sheep were slaughtered, they slaughtered them. It was a small enough price to pay to keep them out of the hands of the law. It wasn't the first time he went out on a limb when his men were in trouble. You never know what the hired help might let slip when they think their boss has abandoned them.
But why would Richard take such a risk? He was robbing himself.
That's how he wanted it to look, and it's why he staged that robbery last week with me as a witness to draw suspicion away from him. You said yourself he's almost bankrupt. He put his blue bandanas up to stealing his payroll, convinced outside investors to make it up, and had them steal that, too. He paid his hand-picked bandits out of the first amount and probably cut them in for a piece of the rest and all of whatever they foraged on the side so it wouldn't look like he was the only victim. He pocketed the lion's share. Do you know the details of the trouble he got into up in Montana Territory? She watched me.
Is this another attempt to worm information out of me?
That time's past. Blackthorn came clean, finally, when I pressed him. 12 years ago, Freemason was clerk of the U.S. District Court in Helena. That was shortly after Blackthorn took the bench, and 2 years before I came to work for him. Your husband embezzled $20,000 from the operating budget and used it to start a sheep ranch near the Canadian border. He registered the land in the name of his assistant, and when an auditor from Washington turned up the shortfall, the assistant clerk was arrested, tried, and convicted of misappropriation of public funds. Dr. Littlejohn rapped on the door.
"That's long enough, Mrs. Freemason," he called. "The brother needs his rest."
She looked at me. We shook our heads simultaneously. She got up, recovered his instrument case, and went to the door. A moment of spirited conversation followed, ending when she passed the bag around the edge of the door, closed it, and turned the key in the lock. She returned to her seat. I said, "I think you just cost me a parishioner."
"Does it matter?"
"Not to me, but I don't think I'll be named a saint of the Unitarian Church." I rubbed my chest. I was giving my bruised lungs a workout. "It fell apart in the end," I went on. "The assistant's wife hired investigators who reviewed the records of the transaction at the county seat where the ranch was and established that his signature was forged. It came too late for the assistant. A highwayman serving 10 to 15 years for stealing U.S. securities picked a fight with him in the federal penitentiary in Deer Lodge and let his brains out with a chunk of masonry."
"How much of this can you prove?"
"It's public record." Her knuckles tightened on the reticule in her lap.
"Richard said he was sentenced to 7 years. President Grant pardoned him after 3 months. 5 of the 20,000 went to the congressman who delivered the Republican vote in 72. All this time I thought Blackthorn's complaint was political."
The assistant clerk's name was Velasquez. His father was a prisoner of war during the fighting in Mexico. Blackthorn liked him, but Velasquez turned down his offer to sponsor him after the war.
When his son came of age, he called in the marker. The judge is vain and petty, but he believes in justice, the Presbyterian Church, and his personal obligations in that order. He didn't say it. That damn code he uses takes too long on both ends, and he never explains himself anyway. But my guess is, when he heard Freemason's name in connection with the robberies here, he wasn't sure enough of his suspicions to tell me and possibly send me off in the wrong direction. If his hunch was right, I'd stumble on it myself. In a way, it was a vote of confidence from the son of a bitch.
The son of a bitch, she agreed. I might have gone on thinking I'd pulled myself out of the muck finally.
Not you. You're too smart for Freemason. You'd have seen through him soon enough.
Not as soon as you.
I'm not married to him.
You're smart enough to outsmart yourself, she said.
You knew when you told him Luther Cherry had confessed to being a spy for the Blue Bandanas, he knew you were lying. If Cherry didn't set up that robbery on the road to clear himself, it had to have been Richard. You might as well have accused him straight out. If I did, he'd have thought I had enough information to arrest him. As long as he believed I was still building a case, he had a chance to prevent me from delivering it. That's why I turned Captain Jordan away when he said he wanted to ask Brother Bernard more questions in private. As long as Freemason thought I was the only one who suspected him, I could flush him out by drawing his fire. I did outsmart myself, I said, nodding. I didn't think he'd mount a direct assault on me in the church, his church. He's more desperate than I thought. She shook her head.
Less. He's beaten the system twice with pardons. Once you're out of the way, he's convinced he's invincible.
A common failing in men of influence. You ought to set your sights on a lowly road agent.
Paige, that's unkind even for you.
I looked at her, and the expression on her face surprised me more than the bullet through the window. Moisture glittered like bits of quartz in the corners of her eyes. If she had brought that to a poker table, I'd have cleaned her out. A floorboard shifted outside the door. The squeak was sharp in the quiet of the room. She stood, rustling her skirts and muttering something about the damn doctor. Before she got to it, the door sprang open and struck the wall on our side. The man who'd kicked it lunged through the opening on the force of his own momentum, grabbed Colleen's shoulder, and spun her to face me with a forearm across her throat. He spun the Spencer rifle in his other hand by the lever, working around into the chamber, and leveled it at me.
"Beg pardon, Reverend," he said. "It being the Lord's own day and all."
His speech was as wide as West Texas, muffled a little by the blue bandana that covered his face to the eyes. Chapter 27. My hand twitched in the direction of the revolver on the nightstand, but I let it fall when he flexed his arm, drawing a strangled croak from Colleen.
"You're square with Jesus, Reverend, but maybe the lady ain't. Push that English pistol off the edge easy."
I did, using the tips of my fingers. The Dean Adams struck the floor with a thud. The man with the rifle relaxed his grip a notch. Colleen sucked in air in a long draft.
"I'll have that strong box from the morning," he said. "I heard you raked it in."
"Is that why you shot at me?"
"That was careless. By the time I got to the door, the place was crawling. There's still a crowd got their snouts stuck to the windows. I figure if they see you lug that box out, they won't think anything about it."
"They will if I'm with a masked man with a rifle."
"You won't be. The lady and me'll just make ourselves to home here till you get back."
"What if I just keep walking?"
"Well, now, that wouldn't set just right with the Almighty. When you get through them pearly gates, she'll be waiting with a slug in her head. Same thing if you come back with anybody or anything but that box."
"Is it all right if I get dressed?"
"Sure. We can't have the parson slanching about half naked. Wouldn't be decent."
I slid out from under the sheet on his side opposite where I'd dropped the revolver, retrieved my shirt, collar, and coat from the heap where the doctor had left them when he examined me, and drew them on slowly, my fingers fumbling with the collar button behind my neck. I knew the man and his weapon from the road to Freemason's ranch, and I didn't believe for a second that he'd come just for the church collection. He was Freemason's man. I wasn't to survive the transaction to bear witnesses against his employer. The box was extra incentive and cover for my murder. "Jack, I can make up the difference if you'll just leave. Jack Collender, Richard Freemason's foreman, choked her off with his arm. In that instant, I saw confusion in his eyes and satisfaction in Colleen's. If the plan was to leave her alive to back up the robbery theory, she'd just tipped it on its head. Plainly, he hadn't orders in case she identified him. The rancher had stopped short of condemning his wife. I pressed in. "You weren't told some other things. The name's Murdoch, not Sebastian. I'm a deputy U.S. Marshal." The confusion crystallized into something else. He'd made up his mind in favor of his own survival and to hell with Freemason. "That makes things easier. I'd sooner slaughter a wolf than a lamb. Now fetch that box." I pulled up my braces and turned toward the door, sliding one hand into a sleeve of my rusty black coat. "I got men on roofs with repeaters," Collender said, "in case she ain't reason enough to come back. When I hear shooting, I'll put one in her and clear out." I turned back his way, still half in and half out of the coat. It put me a step closer. "You'll do it anyway, and you'll put one in me, too, as soon as I show up with the money. Why should I waste the time walking all the way to the church and back?" "On account of every minute's one more you got, both of you." For emphasis, he arched his back, tightening his grip and pulling Colleen off her feet. That was a mistake. She'd been preoccupied with keeping both feet on the floor to avoid strangling under her own weight. Now she scissored one leg and raked the heel of her pump down his right shin blade, probably drawing blood. He cursed in a high, shrill voice. I whirled my coat underhand in a circle, caught the Spencer's muzzle with the hem, and jerked it toward the ceiling, which blew apart with a shower of plastic chunks and dust when the trigger jerked his finger. In the shock of the moment, he relaxed his forearm. Colleen ducked out from under, grasping at the barrel of the rifle with both hands. She failed to gain a purchase, and as he swept it out of her reach, he slammed the stock against the side of her head. She collapsed on top of me. I dived for the Dean Adams on the floor, but got one foot tangled on the rung of the straight-back chair beside the bed, and all three of us, me, Colleen, and the chair, wound up in a snarl of flesh and bone and pine. I groped for the revolver and found only plank floor. Something clacked twice, the lever of a repeater jacking a shell into the barrel. A huge black bat flew across my vision. My coat caught on the front sight of Collender's Spencer. I wouldn't even see where the bullet was coming from. A shot cracked. I flinched as if I were hit. Something heavy struck the floor hard enough to shake more plaster from the shattered ceiling. It spilled like salt onto the back of Jack Collender's white duster, spread like angel's wings where he lay splayed out on his face, his arms flung out in the shape of a cross. A needle of brimstone stung my nostrils, coming from the barrel of the small, slim American arms pistol in Colleen's kid leather palm. Her reticule lay open on the floor where it had fallen when I'd knocked over the chair. Gunfire crackled outside. Hollow in the open and bent by the wind, it might have been a string of firecrackers going off. In the West, every holiday is an occasion for fireworks. I found the Dean Adams finally. It had skidded under the bed in the scramble, and got up. Colleen, athletic as ever, was already on her feet. I felt as if a dray had run over my chest, leaving deep ruts. I still feel it sometimes when I've lived wrong. I nearly shot Captain Jordan coming in the door. Colleen came closer. I caught her elbow with an uphand sweep just as she emptied her second barrel. The little slug dashed yellow splinters out of the doorframe just above the ranger's head.
He had on the same clothes I'd seen him in last, riding gear, and carried a sawed-off Stevens 10-gauge shotgun in both hands, crossways to his body like a quarterstaff. His face was red beneath the deep bronze. His eyes went straight from the distraction of the shot to the body on the floor.
"Dead," I said. "What about the rest?"
"One dead, one on his way. We winged another. One threw up his hands. Two more run off, but we know where they're headed. We followed them here from the ranch. I didn't exactly go back to Wichita Falls after I left here the other night," he said. "I wish I'd known. I couldn't get word to you without scaring them back into cover."
Belatedly, he took off his hat, watching Colleen.
"We need to talk to your husband, Mrs. Freemason. You too, maybe."
"She's out in the open," I said. "She's the one who shot Colander."
He cradled the shotgun along a forearm, slid the hat off the back of the dead man's head, pulled it up by a fistful of hair, and tore loose the bandana. It was a stubbled face with sandy mustaches and spider traces of blood coming from the corners of his mouth.
"Colander, that's the name?"
Jordan spoke to Colleen over his shoulder.
"That's him. Richard's at the house, or was when I left. I don't think he'll resist. It's past the time for gunplay. Now it's the lawyer's turn."
"We'll bring our guns along just the same," I said. "You can't sneak up on him. His house overlooks the whole town."
"He built it to withstand cattle wars," Colleen said. "You can shoot at it all day and all night. All you'll do is break China."
Jordan chewed the ends of his handlebars. In his weathered face, I saw faint traces of the fresh features of the young ranger in the photograph in his office. It had been taken at Fort Sill, where the Comanche Nation had surrendered after breaking its back assaulting a handful of buffalo hunters holed up at adobe walls.
"Man has to eat," he said finally. "We'll wait him out."
Colleen said,
"I'll talk to him. I've always been able to make him listen to reason."
"No, ma'am. I'll not put a chip in his hands."
"I don't have to ask your permission. It's my house. You can place me under restraint, but I'll put up a fight. It will take 3 men. How many do you need to lay siege to a fortress?"
He looked at me. I shook my head.
"I wouldn't argue with her. I still have scars,"
she said.
"He's no ordinary fugitive. He has resources. The chances are he's already put them to work. Why risk panicking him with an attack party?"
"Well, hell," he said, and that was the end of the resistance. I unhooked my coat from the end of Colander's Spencer and shrugged into it. The hole he'd blown through it had smoldered for a while, but it had stopped, leaving an evil smell.
"You fixin' to come with us?" Jordan asked.
"If you'll have me. This is the first time I've had the blinders off since Helena."
"Let's get to it, then, before our past life catches up with us."
I asked him for a moment and went to get my Bible. Colleen and Jordan watched in silence as I read over the dead man. When I finished, I closed the book, put it in my side pocket, and took off the clerical collar. I put it on the bed and picked up the Dean Adams.
Chapter 28. Afternoon was well along. Moving into position, our party threw saguaro-shaped shadows halfway across the street. The sun painted crimson stripes on the wrought iron spikes that crowned the American castle on its man-made hill and reflected in flat sheets off the mullioned windows facing west, turning them into armor plate. There was nothing preposterous about the place now. It might have stood through the Crusades and expected to stand until the end of all things. The businesses on both sides of the street were closed for the holy day, but Jordan had sent a man, it was Corporal Thompson, the young ranger who'd put me up overnight in Wichita Falls with a wife expecting a child, to roust out the shopkeepers stacking stock and recording inventory and persuade the residents of the houses to stay inside and away from the windows.
It had taken him half an hour, but the captain hadn't wanted to alert Freemason by sending a party. He was being overcautious. All our quarry had to do was look out and see all the merchants locking up at the same time to know something was in the wind. In times past, Texas being Texas, the neighbors would have been recruited to serve in the assault, supplying their own weapons and ammunition, but the second generation of pioneers had moved into the protected category, like the people they'd left behind in the cities of the East. In 20 years, maybe less, citizens' posses would be a part of history, and professionals firmly in place to defend the peace unassisted. There would be a policeman on every corner, and no more deputy marshals required to ride circuit over an area the size of New Hampshire. It was progressive, inevitable, but I smelled in it the stink of my own grave. As the light shifted, so did the demeanor of the gaunt house on its unnatural heap. It looked vulnerable, indecently so, as if by design. The heavy seed shutters I'd noticed on my first visit yawned wide, as if Freemason had declared open house. The thought chilled me there in the bright sun, in the hot wind. I felt suddenly as if we were the ones being hunted. Jordan, directing operations from the deep doorway of the Catholic Church, saw what I saw and reached a different conclusion. Lit out, I expect. If he's forded up at the ranch, I'm gonna have to send to San Antonio for more men. It'll take days. I said nothing. When the rangers were all in place, stationed at second-story windows and in narrow alleys, Colleen Bauer emerged from the First Unitarian Church. She'd put herself back together after the wrestling match in the parsonage, pinned her hat in place, and with her reticule wound around her wrist, without the pistol which Jordan had taken charge of, the First Lady of Owen might have been returning home from one of her regular errands. When she drew abreast of us, I stepped forward. The captain touched my arm. "There's nothing for it if she gets hurt," he said. "The governor don't pay enough pension to look after my crippled cousin. It's the best way to take him alive. If he turns himself in through her, he'll go to his lawyers instead of his gunmen. Anyway, you've seen what happens when someone tries to hold her down." I caught up with her, and we walked like two strangers bound in the same direction, without speaking. We climbed the long flight of steps to the front door. She'd asked for 5 minutes alone with her husband. I'd determined to give her 2. I hung back while she twisted the bell, waited, then twisted it again. It rang away back in a place of desertion. She turned my way. "Fiello only leaves the house when Richard sends him. He can't think it's an ordinary day." I didn't know whether she meant Freemason or the servant, but I wasn't sure of that either way. Those spread shutters haunted me. I didn't agree with Jordan that he'd flown to cover at the ranch. The situation was just the one the house had been planned and built for. I'd faced apparent traps before, but now I felt as if I were fighting the urge to walk right into one. The oath I'd taken had said nothing about battling my own nature. I settled the point. When she untied her bag and fished out a key, I took it from her and moved her aside with a firm hand on her elbow. I drew the Dean Adams and unlocked the door. No one shot at me when I eased it open, using the thick door for a shield. The foyer was empty except for furniture. So were the adjoining rooms when I prowled through them, the baronial dining hall and a long kitchen with an enormous white enamel jewel stove and, suspended from the ceiling, clusters of copper and cast-iron pots and skillets. The air smelled of stale grease and dry herbs, as if no meal had been prepared there in months. A tiny room off the kitchen contained a cot, a small chest of drawers, and a wash basin on a stand. The servants' quarters abandoned also. A back door opened on a path worn through grass to a privy out back. I didn't check that. It was no place to hide with a fortress waiting. There was one door I hadn't tried, but I didn't think it was for me to try it. I returned to the front step where Colleen, obedient for once, waited. She asked me if I'd looked in the study. "No." She read my face. I wished I knew what she saw there. I was behind it, and I had no idea. She said, "He feels safe there." I nodded and stepped aside. She looked at me, not so much curious as inviting an explanation.
"It's your house."
She came in, and I followed her down the hallway, 3 steps behind, with the revolver pointed toward the ceiling. She knocked at the stout paneled door, spoke his name. No one answered. She tried the knob. Locked. He has the only key. She stepped away without being asked, while I hammered on the door. My fist boomed like cannon practice. No strategic satisfaction. It was the quietest house I'd ever been in. Even a fallen-in shack on the prairie has something scuttling around inside. I didn't try kicking. It was too much door, and it had a heavy brass lock. One of the sculptures that decorated the house was a bronze casting of a Knight Templar drawing his sword, the inescapable Masonic symbol emblazoned on his shield. It stood 3 feet high at the end of the hallway on a tall fluted pedestal with a marble base. I pocketed the Dean Adams, hoisted the statue off its stand, and signaled Colleen to stand clear. I set myself and rammed the lock. It held, but on the second try I put a dent in the knight's helmet and got a splitting sound. A long shard of polished wood came away from the frame on the third. I laid the statue on the floor, fisted the revolver, and threw a heel at the lock. The door flew open with less resistance than expected, and I caught the frame hard with my right shoulder to avoid falling headlong. It was the pulpit all over again. Pain racked me from front to back, but the muzzle of the .45 found Richard Freemason in his embossed leather chair as if I'd trained it. He sat slumped in his shirt sleeves and a scarlet waistcoat, turned a quarter of the way on his swivel toward the tall, massive desk. He hadn't moved even when the door exploded against the wall. I saw why when I approached him and turned the chair my way by its back. He wasn't wearing a red waistcoat, or one of any other color. The knife that had nearly separated his head from his trunk had opened his jugular all down the front of his shirt. Only the whites of his eyes showed, and they were no more pale than his face. I heard a high keening sound, but Colleen wasn't crying. It was my own breath straining to get in and out after another blow to the lungs and the strain of using a hunk of bronze the size of a newborn calf for a battering ram. I found out later the thing weighed 140 pounds. It took 2 men to put it back on its pedestal. No, she wasn't crying, but her voice was tight. "He's taken his own life." I didn't mention that there was no knife. For all I was aware, she knew where it was. She didn't. The rangers found him, finally, in the little privy I hadn't bothered to look inside. In my defense, I'll add that they only thought of it after they'd searched the house from the upstairs bedrooms, the ballroom with its fabulous chandelier, and water closet to the coal furnace in the basement. He was propped primly with his back against the plank wall, sitting in his white linen uniform on the flip-down seat, his long brown hands dangling between his thighs, the wrists sliced open almost neatly with what was probably the same knife he'd used to cut Freemason's throat, a butcher's tool with a curved blade still razor-sharp after it had done its work. Part of a set from the kitchen, it lay on the floor between his sandaled feet. A bottle of Hermitage with a teaspoonful of whiskey left in the bottom stood beside him on the seat. The liquor had thinned his blood, accelerating the process, but he was an old man and his heart had given out first. Colleen cried when she was told, as she hadn't for her husband. Her affection for the gentle old manservant was genuine. I guessed what it was about, with intuition pumped up like my strength under pressure and pain, but I kept it to myself. It all came out when they searched him and found the note in the same pocket where he'd placed the key he'd used to lock his master's body in the study. He'd wanted time to write it and see the thing through. He'd used a sheet of Colleen's notepaper as if he refused to touch Freemason's Masonic stationery. It was written in a surprisingly fine hand, in Spanish. but the translation could wait. He'd signed it Fiello Velasquez.
The 13th Apostle. I have glorified thee on the earth. I have finished the work which thou gavest me to do. From John, chapter 17, verse 4. Beyond some follow-up questions to my report, Judge Blackthorne and I never discussed my time in Texas again. He went to his grave without another word on the subject. I can't make the same claim, although mine lies open before me. I made mistakes that cost lives, souls too, and while I'm less certain than ever about what's waiting, Owen is one burden I'm determined to leave behind. I have to include Eldred Griffin among the casualties. The doll's house in the Catholic cemetery was shut up when I went there to return the shabby sheaf of sermons, the shutters fastened and the padlock on the front door. His death, punctuation to the gossip that had hounded him for years, was still lively after 2 weeks. His wife Esther had gone to his study to pour him a second cup of tea and found him dead on the floor, fallen in a heap from his chair where he'd been seated at his writing table, sipping his first and reading an Aramaic text from the 3rd century. Grubs hindered the growth of sod between the graves. Arsenite of lead was discovered in quantity on the premises, and one or two details about the condition of the corpse persuaded a coroner's jury to rule death by misadventure. No suspicion fell upon Esther. The rumor of suicide moved Father Medavoy of the Cathedral of the Sacred Hearts of Jesus and Mary to refuse interment in hallowed ground. Esther boxed up the remains and shipped them to her sister in Michigan, accompanying them in a day coach. I never found out if she sought or found reunion with her other relations. I wonder frequently if Griffin's part in my imposture had deprived him of his last shred of faith, or if he kept it and, like Judas in his Easter sermon, chose eternal damnation to punish himself for questioning. Either way, his fate lies heavily upon me. Dr. Lawrence Lazarus Little, proprietor of the Traveling Tabernacle, settled in California, and 40 years later, at the age of 82, became one of the first ministers to preach over the ether. On certain nights when the air was clear, his 500-watt electric pulpit came crackling over my set in Los Angeles. The booming voice had grown reedy with time, and I realized then that that astonishing baritone had provided 90% of his message, taking the place of conviction. Griffin had seen past it at its peak. Richard Freemason's 800-acre sheep ranch was broken up by his widow and sold to satisfy his creditors, including the state of Texas, to which he owed property taxes in the thousands. The largest parcel went to the brother of a bishop in Dublin who took pleasure in stripping away all the Masonic symbols, including the brand. I never heard what became of Captain Andrew Jackson Jordan of the Texas Rangers. I assume he retired because Governor Ireland transferred the rest of the Wichita Falls office to San Antonio shortly after the last of the Blue Bandanas was captured and sentenced to hang. And Jordan had made no secret of his opposition to committing all the Rangers' best men to the bandit problem on the border at the expense of the Panhandle. I picture him living out the rest of his days smoking his pipe on the front porch on some small spread where he looked after his cousin. Its abandonment by the Rangers, together with the bad reputation left by Freemason, took Owen out of the running for a railroad spur from Wichita Falls. It passed south to create Amarillo, which promptly became the principal city in a region the size of many states. That should have been the end of Owen, but it had demonstrated its tenacity before. The sheep trade, with a shot in the arm from the newly passed fence-cutting law, kept the town alive at the cost of the saloon business. For some reason, sheep hands in those days were more conservative carousers than cowboys. Freemason's house, I'm told, still stands, converted appropriately into a county home for the insane.
I'm living out my time in a comfortable bungalow with a view of a swimming pool, the latest in a series of enthusiasms to claim Southern California. I don't swim. One immersion is enough for a lifetime, even if it's a better prospect than a buffalo wallow. But the improbably blue water is pleasant to look at, a rare luxury for a movie, which is a noxious class restricted by many landlords. Movies are employees of the picture business. I make my rent peddling my experience to producers who admire to include an old frontier lawman in press releases promoting their westerns. I'm freelancing now. I had a nice billet with United Artists, Chaplin and Pickford's outfit, but they let me go when a newspaper hack in the pay of a rival studio wrote that Paige Murdoch had been gunned down in Helena in 1884, and that I was an imposter. It wasn't the first time Blackthorne's harebrained ruse cast doubt on my identity. But the place is rotten with frauds, and I managed to avoid eviction by the grace of UA's less discriminating competitors. How long it will last, I can't say. I'll be clay soon enough, so I have no worries about corporeal matters. My spiritual condition is something else. I'm writing down my confessions. They'd fill a good-sized trunk, and I have to sit on the old Wells Fargo strongbox I keep them in to lock it. It's bolted to the floor to discourage theft. It's a small town, word gets around, and scenarists are always pestering me for a look, which means they want to loot them for ideas. A safe deposit box would be more convenient. At least I wouldn't have to guard the pages at night with the venerable Dean Adams. But I chased too many bandits in the old days to place much faith in banks. Anyway, I'm writing not to be read, but for the sake of my immortal soul. I search the Bible for comfort, with its pages falling out of the worn-out binding, and I say my prayers every night, mostly for the dead and partly for myself, because I sent more than a few of them to hell and maybe one or two to heaven. My soul isn't pure. Fiello Velasquez left the stain. I didn't put that knife in his hand, but I might have prevented him from taking it up. He was the right age, the right nationality, and I should have seen something in the mysterious way he came to work for Richard Freemason, especially after I read that coded message about the son of Blackthorne's old friend who had died a death in prison that should have been Freemason's. I don't know why Fiello waited so long, or why he chose that day of all days to take a father's revenge, except perhaps that he might have sensed that time was running short and that he was about to be cheated out of it. Old men are prescient, I know now. And like Griffin, he'd followed the example set by Judas. I suppose that puts Freemason's fate on my head as well, but I don't spend as much time praying for him as I do most of the others. Colleen buried the old man in the cemetery maintained by the First Unitarian Church. I don't know who presided, because I'd left by then. Fiello was barred, of course, from the Catholic, but a number of mourners came out for the service in support of the first widow of Owen, whose bereavement under the circumstances seemed to have removed her, at least temporarily, from that order of women that is accepted because of position, but not respected. She had a carriage packed with luggage and left town directly from the graveside. Her late husband's legal firm in St. Louis sent someone out to supervise the disposition of the ranch and the house in town. Luther Cherry's widow experienced the same social promotion, but of a more permanent nature. After a respectable year, she married a Missouri state senator who went on to serve 2 terms in Congress and maybe our next vice president, or a member of a railroad board of directors, which is the logical alternative. She may have been worth the preposterous expense of writing her by special delivery from Texas at that. I feel no guilt for what happened to Cherry, but I ask forgiveness for maligning him afterward, necessary as it was to flush Freemason from cover. These days I spend a lot of time thinking about Colleen Bauer. We met a few times after Owen, but I lost her trail after Blackthorne died and Washington sliced his jurisdiction into several easily corruptible pieces. Some years ago, I thought I recognized a familiar figure in a Saturday Evening Post piece about an old gringa, name unknown, who organized arms shipments to Pancho Villa from El Paso and delivered provisions to revolutionists hiding in the caves of Chihuahua from General Pershing's punitive expedition following the raid on Columbus, New Mexico. The artist's rendition, taken from an American poster offering a reward for her capture, resembled Colleen around the eyes, but her hair had gone gray and the desert sun had cracked her fair complexion, so I wasn't sure. Villa's men called her Nuestra Madre de la Orilla, Our Lady of the Border. U.S. authorities called her an enemy of the state. That sums her up, in my opinion.
The End. You've been listening to The Book of Murdoch by Lauren D. Estelman, narrated by Richard Ferrone. This book is copyrighted 2010 by Lauren D. Estelman. This recording is copyrighted 2010 by Recorded Books. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.